Accession number 21095, reel 18.
Hello, Pick. Reel 18.
Now, I spent a great deal of time in Poland from 75 onwards, really until the fall of the war. Kept on and on coming back to Poland because in many ways it always made more news than any of the other communist bloc countries. When I started going there, of course, there was no question of solidarity or Solidarność. And when I tried to map out what I would do as East-West affairs correspondent, it was perfectly obvious that it couldn't be done on the same kind of basis of uncovered America, because you had to have visas wherever you went. Secondly, it was clearly not going to provide the kind of access that one has in the United States or anywhere in the West. Everything had to be negotiated. You were very much in the hands of official organizations that dealt with the foreign press. You couldn't just zoom in and pick up a phone and say, I want to see X, Y, Z. Everything had to be prearranged, and beginning with the visas, which was difficult. But anyhow, so when I first started going to Poland, it meant that I would make a visa application, I would wait till the visa was granted. Then, of course, you were very much in their hands what hotel you were allowed to stay in. In Poland, there was an element of choice, but at the beginning, certainly it was much more restricted. Later, it became much easier, but there weren't many hotels anyhow. But I remember I had to stay, when I first went, in something called the Europejskie, which was beloved by some Western journalists and which I absolutely loathed and detested, because you had tiny little rooms, always very hot if you went there in the winter, horrible little sort of shower rooms. It was really nasty, worse, I think, than the Inn Tourist Hotel in Moscow, which was the hotel in Moscow that one usually had to stay in as a foreign journalist. And also from the, in the Europejskie, it was very hard to get telephones that worked and to file your copy. And, you know, it was always a huge problem. How were you going to get your copy, what you were writing, away from the country where you were? But anyway, when I first went, you would go to the official foreign press center, tell them, you know, the kind of people you would like to meet and so on and so forth, and some they would arrange, others not, but you could be very certain that any official that you went to see, they would just give you whatever the official line was. And this predated the emergence of Solidarność. And one of the people that most Western journalists were taken to in those days was the editor of a weekly paper called Politica, which was, in many respects, the freest of the censored magazines anywhere in the communist bloc. They appeared to have a degree of license to criticize and to present a sort of more honest picture of what was going on in Poland in the communist bloc than a great many other papers. And this appeared to be thanks to someone called Mieczysław Rakowski, who was then the editor of Politica, who later became Prime Minister of Poland, and who has been a very ambiguous figure in Poland for a very long time. We ended up becoming very good friends, and even though I accept and recognize all the arguments that are advanced against him, and there are a great many people who not just dislike him but really hate him, and that includes a great many Poles, I always found him an extraordinarily interesting figure, and to the extent that you could expect any communist to be labeled as a liberal, I think he was. I think he was a radical, and I think he certainly recognized that communism would implode long before a lot of other people did. but that's by the by. But my sort of links with him were certainly extremely useful later on in Poland, because he was always a key figure who, in the end, also gave me access to Jaruzelski when he was president, and enabled me to interview him and so on, which I think was important, even if, again, there were some Western journalists who criticized me very much for doing that kind of thing, who felt that one should only, later on, after Solidarity had emerged, one should only be in contact with the opposition and should ignore the government. I just don't think that journalism is there to take sides. I think you have to talk to all sides, and I think it was useful. But anyhow, that was in the... So in the early days, I had a sort of glimmer of what might be going on behind the scenes. I did go to a big party, Polish party congress, which was really my first experience of sort of being sort of just drowning in propaganda, speech after speech after speech, lauding the system and so on and so forth. Very little criticism. But then came the Polish Pope, and in 79 I went to Poland to cover the Pope's first return visit to Poland after his elevation. And that was, I think, for everyone who participated in it, just the most extraordinary happening, because Poles to this day are talking about it, because they know that that was the beginning of the end for communism in Poland, because for the first time Poles understood that it was possible for them to come out in huge numbers and stand up for their beliefs. And of course the Pope, even though he was very careful and tried to steer away from politics, but of course his message, however cloaked it was in language, meant that he was telling Poles, stand up for your rights, your religion is there to support you, and communism is antichrist. And as it is an extraordinary committed, the Poles are, or certainly were at that time, really committed to the church. It meant it was hugely important. And I remember I just couldn't believe that so many people could turn up for anything, and some of these open air masses were really very, very impressive. I do remember the outing to Częstochowa, where they had the Black Madonna, where and we were quite close to where the press were quite close to where the Pope was, because I mean these gatherings were in their hundreds of thousands. I mean this wasn't just handfuls of people, and we were watching the nuns who were quite close to the altar, and they were sort of wrapped in such amazing sort of love and admiration, and it really felt quite sexual. I mean, you could sort of see here with these women so attracted to this Pope, who at that time, of course, was younger and very strong, powerfully built man. But we went to his birthplace. But I have to say, there was also one very, very sobering visit. I think I alluded to that before, when he went to Auschwitz to conduct a mass there, and I think I've probably said that before, but we, the journalists, were made to sit on the railway tracks, where the wagons, where the railway coaches had been brought in during the Holocaust, and where people had been thrown out of the wagons and then selected either for instant death or for hard labor and probably later death. And there we were sitting on that very spot. And the Pope conducted his mass and had not invited any rabbis to join him for this service, which seemed very strange. And amongst the survivors who had been invited, I think 95% of them were Catholics, and he had not gone out of his way to invites, or the Vatican has not gone out of its way to, or the Polish Church, whoever done the selection of who should be invited, had not invited many Jews. And I found that quite extraordinary. And what, you know, made it even worse in personal terms was that we, the place where they had installed the telephones for the media to file their stories, was in the watchtowers which the Nazis had used to make quite certain that absolutely nobody could ever escape. So it was, for me personally, it was really a very difficult event to cover, to put it mildly. But made one question, of course, all over again, to the extent to which Poles have a sort of anti-Semitic streak from which they simply cannot rid themselves. But nevertheless, and then I remember on the last day, the last day of the Pope's visit, we were in Krakow, and the press, we were all invited to come to the Archbishop's palace there, and we were standing in a courtyard there, and the Pope appeared on a balcony to bless us all. And I was standing next to Mirtek Rakowski, who was there still in his capacity as editor of Politico, and he turned to me and he said, "Hella, things will never be the same again after this visit," and how right he was. Of course, it wasn't many months later that Lech Walesa stood and defended the rights of the workers of the shipyards of Gdansk. The interesting thing, for me, interesting thing was, because I happen to remember it, a bit of personal pride, I suppose, I was in London just as there was a sort of glimmering of something happening in Gdansk, and it was a Sunday afternoon, and I was at the Guardian to write, and I wrote a story about this movement which seemed to be developing in Poland, and how significant it was likely to be, and there were obviously going to be big strikes, and you know, no one could see what the outcome would be. I can't remember the exact piece, but anyway, the Guardian's foreign editor, Ian Wright, who was also working that afternoon, had by chance come to my desk and seen what I was writing and thought it was very important, and he sold it, I said that in inverted commas, because at editorial conferences later in the day there are always discussions about what should be the front page lead. And anyway, for one reason or another, probably it was a day when there weren't many other news, they decided to lead the paper with that story. So I thought I had personally launched solidarity in the Guardian. But anyhow, and then of course after that things moved very fast indeed, and solidarity became the force that it was. And then before too long martial law was declared. Now, I went in and out of Poland during that time, trying to cover it as best I could. When martial law itself was declared, I was in London. That was just before Christmas again in 1981, if I remember rightly. And every day the diplomatic correspondents, and myself included, would go into the Foreign Office, where the Foreign Office was obviously receiving news from, at that point, I mean, there was complete censorship, and Western correspondents in Poland were unable to find any real stories. What a lot of them did was to go to the British Embassy in Warsaw and sort of filter through what they knew. And in any event, the embassy, on its secret communications links, clearly filed to London more or less what they knew was going on in Poland. And the Foreign Office spokesman had a daily task of reading out to us some of the information that was coming through. And they as always, you know, the Foreign Office is very quirky. They would not let us tape what they were telling us. We had to write things down by hand. I mean, it was always like that at briefings. We were never allowed to tape. We always had to take notes. But it was quite ridiculous there, because they would stand there dictating to us instead of making life easy for everybody all around. They wouldn't. So, you know, we went there for these daily dispatches, and I don't know how long that lasted, I suppose about 2 or 3 weeks, and then it gradually sort of opened up to the extent that the correspondents who were in Poland could file their stories, though it all went through censorship. I mean, most of the time, though, there was little they could do to control articles that were being telephoned, because the telephone lines, curiously enough, were opened up. I can't remember anymore how the opening up of the telephone lines came, but after a while, because then I started going back quite frequently, and we all of us then stayed in the same God, what was it called? Thank you. How dreadful. At the Victoria Hotel, which became a sort of home from home, and most of us were always on the sixth or seventh floor, which was obviously completely wired for whatever we were doing, but they were very nice to us in that hotel, and at least it was comfortable and pleasant, and we knew the menu by heart, and the press centre for the foreign press was just across the street, across the Victoria Square, so it was all very much within walking distance. And we pedalled backwards and forwards, and always there's the monument to the unknown soldier in the middle of Victoria Square, and they would they changed the guard twice a day, and we could always watch this, and any important visitor was always being taken there, and it was all very much it all became so very familiar. And the journalists, of course, all knew each other, and some were there on a permanent basis, others, like myself, just came from time to time.
What was the atmosphere like then? This would have been, during martial law.
During martial law, yes.
And perhaps you could sort of give us some idea of how widespread the solidarity movement was from what you knew.
Well, the solidarity movement was extremely widespread, because Poland is an industrialized country. It was a highly the trade union movement, the official trade union movement, was everywhere, and the workers were very much galvanized. Of course, the great thing that Lech Walesa did at the beginning, and of course which he subsequently after the end of the war, and so to speak, which he lost, was during that whole period in the build-up to martial law, and during the martial law, during what the Poles still call the war, he had linked himself very closely to Poland's intellectuals. And you have to understand that in Poland, the intellectuals are a major group. It's a class. And the intellectual class is hugely important, always very divided. I mean, but during the solidarity period, they patched up a lot of their sort of internal differences. And they stood beside Lech Walesa, so they advised him, he listened to them, because when all is said and done, Lech Walesa was a natural-born leader, but his intellectual background was extremely limited. And he needed to be advised. And, everybody saw it afterwards. As president, he failed completely. But he wouldn't listen to anybody anymore. And this has continued. He ran for presidency a second time. Was bound to end in tears. And he shouldn't have done it. But there was nobody. He no longer listened to the people who would have advised him better. But at that time, they were all together, and that, of course, created the real solidarity, which was meaningful. And a lot of the intellectuals were, of course, detained. Like Walesa, some of them had a very, very rough time indeed. Now, the journalists who were in Poland, who were stationed in Poland on a sort of permanent basis at that time, They all had good links with Solidarity throughout the martial law period. I myself went to see Lech Walesa two or three times in his after he'd been released, because of course he was detained too. But after his release, when he was living in his small apartment in Gdansk, and on each occasion the same thing happened. The interpreter whom came with me, but whom I had recruited, who had not been, and obviously didn't go to the official foreign press center to ask for an interpreter to go with me to see Lech Walesa, though I did say that I was going to go and see him. On each occasion, after we had been, the interpreter was arrested and I was allowed to go back to Warsaw. And then I kicked up a lot of fuss and they released him. But first of all, it showed once again how closely watched we were, because they knew exactly where we were, what we were doing. And also, the extent to which they were harassing anybody who had any kind of links with the Solidarność people, even after they'd been released. But as far as I was concerned, I just want to go back to a lot of the Western correspondents in Poland felt it was enough to be in touch with the dissidents, and that it was certainly beneath their dignity to do more than to go to the regular press briefings in the Foreign Press Center that was given by the then government spokesman Jerzy Urban, who was a very intelligent man, Jewish as it happens, who was, I think, the first and almost the for a long time the only spokesman in the communist bloc who understood how to deal with the Western media. He had clearly observed the way American spokesmen handled the press, and he tried to model himself on that, in the sense that instead of the extraordinary sort of turgid official pronouncements with no questions afterwards, which other communist bloc so-called spokesmen indulged in, if they did it at all, he tried, first of all, to give some information away, and he knew how to banter with journalists and to try and be light-hearted with the heavy of communist jargon, which is not an easy feat, and he did that. And as far as I was concerned, on one or two occasions when I went to see him in his office, he gave me information which really was sort of quite newsworthy, which at the time sort of seemed quite important. Numbers of people who were going to be released, or this, that, and the other. But whatever it was, it was quite helpful. I remember he had an absolutely ghastly office, where one had to sort of sit on uncomfortable red plush seats that were no longer properly sprung, and you sort of got tea and sticky biscuits. And One felt that he thought this was the sort of acme of luxury, when in fact it was really just a terrible office. And then after 79, I was in Poland when I went there with Simon Wiesenthal, and I went to see Jerzy Urban, who at that point had become a newspaper proprietor, and he had started a weekly paper which is, I'm told, extremely salacious and about as close to pornography as you can get, though it always also has some sort of pithy political commentaries by him. And he was installed in the former residence of the Mexican ambassador in Warsaw, and in an absolutely beautiful house, and his office was furnished with the latest Italian office furniture. He had some very good paintings on his wall by contemporary Polish artists. He had next to his office, he had sort of a little sitting room with very comfortable chairs and couches and things, and then there was even a bathroom full of marble and God knows what else. And somebody told me that in his home, which had now become quite a large house in Warsaw, he had a garage with two Jaguars in it, and over the Jaguars there's a painting of Lenin holding out his arms with blessings. And so it just shows he travelled a long way, Mr. Urban. But anyway, in those days, he was quite an important character. And during martial law, of course, there was a curfew. And even though the Western journalists theoretically were not affected by the curfew, there was always the problem, if you were anywhere, how do you get back? So we were very much confined to our evenings in the, as I said, in the restaurant in our hotel, and where we always had to sort of get past the ranks of the prostitutes who were in waiting for whatever person they could pick up. And again, there was something that I simply didn't know how to cope with, because for a long time I kept on getting phone calls in my bedroom at 3-4 in the morning from girls who, they were obviously prostitutes, who, you know, they didn't know that I was a woman. They thought there was a man offering their services. And, you know, I got so aggravated by this, and I went to the desk, and I said, look, can't you, you know, I don't know what goes on, but can't you stop these calls from these women? So they said, no, we can't, because they have they have rooms in the hotel too, and, you know, it's the internal phone system. The only thing we can do is just shut off your phone altogether during the night. So I said, well, I can't do that, because if my paper wants to get in touch with me, I've got to be available. So there was no solution to this problem, but after a while this stopped. But I mean, it really was it was just a nuisance. But the prostitutes all played a great role in the life of these East European hotels.
Visiting Lech Wałęsa, what was that like? Where did he live?
Wałęsa, after his release, and I suppose he lived there before, lived in a sort of tenement block of flats in Gdansk. No lifts, nothing. You had to walk up to the third, fourth floor, wherever he was. And as far as I could tell, it was a sort of two or maybe three room flat, because he did have a lot of children. And you saw him in a small sitting room full of Madonnas and crosses, because of course he is he's a great believer, no doubt about that, and he was always very close to the church. And I think he went on living there for, well, certainly till 89. And I still don't know why. I can't remember in which year he got the Nobel Peace Prize, but that was certainly before 89. And he had formed a very close link with one of the churches in Gdansk and its priest, Father Jankowski. And all the Western journalists always went to that church, because it was full of sort of signatures and things and pieces of paper calling for freedom and an end to communist rule and so on. And Jankowski turned out to be extremely anti-Semitic as well, and really a very bad influence on Wałęsa. But at that time he was still a sort of hero figure, because he'd kept this rather revolutionary church on the go for such a long time. And on the day that Wałęsa got his Nobel Peace Prize, he was in the church, and then as the award ceremony was being broadcast on the Voice of America, a few of us were invited into the back room of the church by Father Jankowski, and Wałęsa was there. And there was one bottle of champagne which they had somehow managed to conjure up, and the prize was accepted by Wałęsa's wife. And as we heard her voice coming over the sort of rather crackly radio, we all drank to Wałęsa's health, and that was a sort of quite a nice moment in one sort of rather humdrum correspondent journalist's existence. But it was nice. But, there were a few journalists, I think, that Wałęsa, who were really very close to him and who saw a lot of him. But people like me, whom he just saw a few times, I don't think he remembered from one time to the next.